those of you who are just at Line of Force talk just now, what I'm going to do this evening, in a way, will be a response. Maybe it's always that way. So my strategy this evening, just to warn you, is to track the deduction and more or less following Allison. And as most of you who've read Allison will now know, it ends rather unsatisfactorily. I'm then going to offer three further interpretations of the justification for judgment of taste. The first that I flagged at the very beginning, called the idea of lost pleasure. The second, following different accounts of necessity, following Therese Longuenes. And the third, following three different interpretations of the harmony of the faculties, following Guire. And look at his third interpretation, which is interesting in itself. So, and I'm not going to actually arbitrate. I'm going to suggest that these are different strategies for thinking about what Kant is up to. And what I mean by that is the question you should be asking yourself about each of the deductive strategies is, what is actually at stake in a judgment of beauty? Why does it matter? And therefore, because each deduction will actually have a differential way of thinking of why we care about the beautiful, why we care about art, what we're doing in these activities. So it's not just three philosophical ideas of what we're up to. It's also three competing ways of thinking hard about the problem in general. Okay, and then I should mention that I have an immense head cold, which, as you know, when you have them, it eats up your brain space. So if there's a kind of lack of brain activity, let me know. We ended last time at paragraph 35. And on any reasonable account, paragraphs 35 and 38 are the core of the deduction. In paragraph 35, the subjective principle of taste is set forth, and then in paragraph 38, it is grounded. In paragraph 35, Kant says that the subjective principle of taste is nothing else but the power of judgment itself. Page 287 is where he lays this out. Now, since a judgment of taste is not based on a concept of the object, in the case of a presentation in which the object is given, it can consist of only in the subsumption of the very imagination under the condition which must be met for the understanding to proceed in general from intuition to concepts. Because we're not bringing the object under a concept, all that can be at stake is the movement in general by which the imagination and the understanding operate as heading toward conceptualization, as the thought of cognition in general. And that's a move from, which I take to be terribly important, the move from intuition to concept, but never achieving the notion of concept. So we're tracking how intuitions are worked up, how they are further elaborated and thought in preparation for being conceptualized, but without conceptualization. In other words, Kant goes on, since the imagination's freedom consists precisely in its schematizing without a concept. So what is the free play of the imagination? The free play of the imagination is nothing other than that activity of generating from the manifold of intuitions a sufficient amount of unity in complexity, or complexity within unity, that would be, if we had a concept, which we don't, the schema of that concept. And that is guided by, not the concept, but by the reflective act of judging itself. So the reflective act of judging is the business of detecting, finding, locating sources of what I'm going to call, just to be provocative, material order. And that material order is the equivalent to a schema, but a schema without a concept. Which is to say, it is it acknowledges the integrity of the object independent of any conceptualization of that object. So it acknowledges that the object itself has a kind of integrity. And what I'm going to say in about 10 minutes is that we that integrity can only be found in our experience of the object. It's not found in the object itself. It's not like locating a structure. It's the experiencing of the object as possessing. So the bearer of that integrity of the object is in the reflecting judgment itself and not independently of it. I'll be coming back to this thought over and over again over the next couple of hours. So, in schematizing without a concept, a judgment of taste must rest on mere sensation. How do I know I've done it? How do I know that I've succeeded in uncovering or in detecting, in having the experience of an integrity of the object without a concept, only by a sensation, but a sensation now that has, as Lyotard puts it, its own reflective dimension. That is, it's not a raw sensation, rather it is Lyotard invents a wonderful word. Tautogorical. Calls it tautogorical sensation. Kind of matching categorical tautology. Right? That is, the structure of my sensory awareness, my sensation, is the mind feeling itself in a mode of satisfaction. And it's that mode of satisfaction, which is the integration of the imagination with the understanding, that we call pleasure. So a judgment of taste must rest on a mere sensation, namely our sensation both of the imagination in its freedom and the understanding with its lawfulness, as they reciprocally quicken each other. The freedom of the imagination is that it is enacting for itself the requirements of unity. But that requirement of unity is the acknowledgement of what is needed for the understanding, were the understanding to be a next step in the process. That is, he says, it must rest on a feeling that allows us to judge the object by the purposiveness that the presentation by which the object is given has insofar as it furthers the cognitive powers in their free play. So the object is experienced as purposive just to the extent to which we can find that possibility of schematizing it without a concept. It's purposive for our powers of cognition, but without any extrinsic purpose. That is, just purposive that way. Yeah?
So then it's like a reflection on the self, and that's why it's a tautology.
I mean, is that exactly why the sensation...
It's just like Hegel, though.
Well, maybe or maybe not.
Okay.
I'll let that rest. So this is, on any account, a Titan redescription of earlier materials. Nothing should be strike us as terribly new here, in the sense that there is a claiming that there is a power of judgment and that the autonomy of judgment takes the form of Kant's own word, if you remember, was autonomy. It's giving the law to itself for its own purposes. So, just about 6 or 7 points. First, notice that the representations are subsumed under the conditions of subsumption. They're not subsumed by a concept, but under the conditions, the subjective conditions of subsumption. Secondly, harmony of the faculties now equals exactly this subsumption. That is, that the normativity of judgment, which is tied to the act of estimation, and not the verdict. X is beautiful. The normativity is of that state of reflective rightness that sensation makes us aware of, and that this is just, again, subsumptive. The work of the imagination then reveals what I'll call the in principle subsumability of the object, although not its actual subsumption under a concept. So it is of a sort that could be subsumed. Fourth point, that the free play of the imagination is said to be equivalent to schematizing without a concept, which fifth hints at a claim that I have been kind of pressing from the beginning, namely, if we are examining the subjective conditions for objective judgment, then Kant here, you almost want to say Hegel here, Kant here is suggesting that if we could not schematize without a concept, we could not schematize at all. And I take that to be the weighty claim, that if we could not schematize without a concept, we could not schematize at all, by which I mean that we could not think that what we are doing is thinking about individual objects rather than mere instances of universals. That's the thought. I can see there's a puzzle. What I mean by that is, if you're a Platonist, then you're going to think that every object is simply an instance or a case of the universal. So that in that case, there's nothing at stake in the individual case. Everything's important is in the universal. Instances are no more than. Right? So if you're a Platonist, you might say that the universal exhausts the object without remainder. To claim, which is to say, nothing new is possible. It is to say that there is and could be no unique individuals. So constant is that in a non-Platonic world, that is a world that is contingent, that is a world in which there is concept formation, concept acquisition, and the extension of concepts to new instances, it must be the case that we have the capacity to schematize without a concept. Otherwise, we could not schematize with a concept, except in the dull sense that we could be, how do I want to put it, object recognition machines, which is what we are most of the time. I'll say more about that in a minute. So, what's yielded as a consequence of this, Allison claims, page 171, a strange and puzzling claim that I don't know quite how to think about. He says, what is finally generated is the exhibition of the form of a concept in general. Now, the reason I'm uncomfortable with that is, it's the exhibition of something like, what is a concept in general that's not a concept, is my question to Allison. I mean, he somehow thinks that schematizing without a concept is nothing more than what schematizing with a concept involves, except you don't have the concept. But in that case, there's no extra to without a concept. Yeah?
The thing is, isn't that a little bit abstract?
Say more.
Well, I mean, like, you reflect on yourself. Like, you don't, like a concept is supposed to be, like, your recognition of something objective, right? And if you don't actually subsume whatever, like, under a concept, then you have no link between, like, the abstract and, you know, the concrete or whatever. So if you don't do that, then all you're left with is the abstractness of it.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly my complaint here.
Oh.
That's exactly my complaint is, I don't know what it means to reveal the exhibition of the form of the concept in general. So we'll leave that as a question mark. And finally, the last point, that the freedom of the imagination and the lawfulness of the understanding together generates a notion of lawfulness without law, of purposiveness without purpose, and of meaningfulness without meaning. Now, what I want to leave those hanging for the moment, but we better have an account of what it might mean to say that there could be lawfulness without law or meaningfulness without meaning. That is, we better have other ways of getting the different sides of those accounts. And I'm going to come up with one a little later. But that seems to be implied by everything that... Let me ask it in another way, going back to those of you that ran the course. What's the difference between philosophy and literature? Right? Somehow, whatever philosophy does, we'll call that meaningful. Right? Literature, in this case, would be meaningfulness without meaning because, as I'll say later, it's non-translatable. That is, it's irreducible. You can't abstract the meaningfulness from the object to somewhere else without losing some notion of meaning. So maybe the difference of meaningfulness without meaning, maybe the difference between, for example, the difference between a determinate concept and a metaphor. Metaphors, you might say, are meaningful without a determinate meaning. We have to see how that could be cashed out. Okay. All this is roughly familiar, but in what sense does it reveal the subjective principle of taste? What Kant means is to say is that X is beautiful, that judgment X is beautiful, is underpinned by the principle or universal rule for judgment. Is just the claim that the normative validity or exemplary necessity of the pleasure felt in connection with a mere judgment of taste of a particular object. So, claim something has normative validity for Kant typically means, if it's an individual case, that it can be brought under some universal. And therefore, he's now looking for, and this is what the deduction's all about, what he's looking for is what's going to stand in the role of the universal, because we don't have one here. Because the very nature of a judgment of taste, right, is that it's unique and made not on the basis of a concept. So his answer as to what stands in place of the universal, sometimes he calls it common sense, sometimes he simply calls it the principle of taste is, as I suggested before, just the power of judgment itself. That is, we can't go far further in justifying the idea. Because there is no rule, the principle, the notion of principle is equivocal here, because there is no rule or criterion of beauty. what is at stake is just the normative validity of single judgment of taste. So you might say that what's at stake is how is it, with what right can we regard it as if under a rule? How are we going to get the as if under a rule? That is, how do we get the grounds for our suggesting that we're entitled to say, this is beautiful, that is, everyone should agree with me. What's the source of that entitlement? And the source of that entitlement then is picked up in, so that's the exposition, and then the actual deduction. Occurs, according to Allison, in three steps. So those of you who have Allison, page 175. Where the defense, what has to be, the principle of judgment is nothing more than the exemplary necessity of the pleasure felt in a judgment of taste. And that's what we're grounding. So Allison does it this way. First step. If it is granted that our pure judgment of taste, our liking for the object, is connected with the mere judging of its form, then this liking is nothing but its subjective purposiveness for judgment, which we sense as connected in the mind with the representation of the object. So the first thought is that the mere judging of the form of an object without a concept is the discovery that that object is suitable for our mental apparatus, purposive for it. It fits it. Our mind finds itself attuned to that object, can work with it, namely it satisfies everything that's needed for us to generate the harmony of imagination and understanding. Step two says, now since with regard to the formal rules of judging, apart from all matter, judgment can be directed only to the subjective conditions of the employment of judgment in general, and hence to that subjective factor that can be presupposed in all men, as is required for the possibility of cognition in general, so it must be allowable to assume that the agreement of representations with these conditions of judgment is valid for everyone a priori. So the argument here is, if the harmony of the imagination and the understanding is interpreted as a necessary requirement for all cognition, and therefore represents the subjective side of every cognitive activity, then since we do have cognitions, then we can assume that the subjective aspect is shared by all human beings. But if the subjective aspect is shared by all human beings, then it must be allowable that anything that satisfies those conditions is valid for everyone a priori. That is, if all that's happening is I'm satisfying the condition, the subjective conditions for cognition in general, and that's got to be the same for everyone since we already share our cognitive judgments, if it is just the subjective side, then I'm entitled to assume it's the same for everyone. But since the object now has simply been found to be purposive for that, then I can assume it's a priori valid. And this is to say, Allison says, the pleasure or subjective purposes of a representation for the relation of the cognitive faculties engaged with judgment of a sensible object in general can, with right, be required of everyone. Just the QED. So all Allison seems to say here is that what is brought into play in a judgment of taste is simply the power of judgment as necessary for the possibility of cognitive judgment. Ergo, I'm entitled to say it's the same for everyone. And how, now the question is, Pam's been going crazy with this, how is this different from paragraph 21? Well, we could argue that in paragraph 21, we were not talking about judgments of taste, but just cognition and common sense. So now, and this is Allison's thesis, a missing step there has been added, namely that the connection between taste and the conditions of cognition. That's Allison's thesis. Now what paragraph 38 adds to the argument of paragraph 21 is that paragraph 21 simply was talking about judgment and imagination as necessary for cognition. He's now adding that the judgment of taste satisfies those very conditions. So he's connecting the judgment of taste to the powers of cognition, saying they are the same powers, only now operating without a concept. And therefore, we're entitled to say they're the same for everyone. At this juncture, and I think this is a mess for obvious reasons, and the reason it's a mess, which is what we're going to be talking about, I guess, for the next hour and a half, is the question we have to answer is, what is the relationship between the relationship of the imagination and the understanding in cognition as compared to the relationship between a judgment of taste, the imagination, and the understanding here? And what we all want to do, what Allison's trying to do, is create a connection between these two. That is, this structure is to map onto somehow this structure. And the question is, how is that mapping to occur? What do we need? Because in this case, it's determined, right, by the concept. And in this case, it's a free play. So what we're trying to map for the deduction is how this can provide justificatory force for this. Right? Allison says, puzzlingly, on page 177, that the deduction affirms the universal validity of this principle of taste on the grounds that it is also a condition of cognition. So he wants to say this will be justified if it, so the line connecting them is judgments of taste are conditions for cognitions. But then he goes on to say, and here's where the whole thing comes apart, though taste is grounded indirectly in the conditions of cognition by showing that its governing principle, the harmony of the faculties, has that status, there is no suggestion that taste itself is such a condition. So he's saying, man, how did he ever get a PhD? That's harsh. Well, it's a cheap shot. But hey, it's Wednesday, I was going to say Thursday night. It's Wednesday night, it's late. So he both wants this to be a condition for cognition and agrees that it can't quite be. So we're left with the gap. So here's the half-truth that seems to me to be kicking away here. The half-truth is that what does or does not conform to subjective conditions of cognition does not automatically extend to any feeling bearing on those conditions. That is, he's right to say that there cannot be a direct mapping without further argument from the judgment of taste to the from the feelings of pleasure to cognition in general. Kant's problem is that he needs a connection between judgments of taste and cognition close enough so that the activity of the judgment of taste puts into play the conditions of cognition, hence providing a grounding claim without identifying the judgment of taste as the subjective conditions of objective judgment. So he needs it close enough so that this can bear on this without creating an identity between the two. And of course they have to be different for the reasons I've just said. One's determined by concept, one by free play.
That, why do we need a universal for judgments of taste? Because it seems like he's arguing that with cognition you have the imagination and understanding together, right? But why can't this just be like a particular instance of the cognition operating?
If it's just but that's exactly what we can't allow, because if it's just a particular instance, then the notion of free play versus determined by a concept is no difference at all. So what we've got to allow is that difference, that one happens schematizing without a concept and schematizing with a concept, have to be significantly different, and yet they have to be related to one another so that the schematizing without a concept bears on the schematizing without a concept without being reducible to it. Well, one version of the link between taste and cognition is stated explicitly in paragraph 39, page 292, the very last paragraph of section 39. Where he says, And you may say we're just going to be working over the same territory, but let's see if that's true. He says, on the other hand, the pleasure we take in the beautiful is a pleasure neither of enjoyment nor of a law-governed activity, nor yet of reasoning contemplation governed by ideas, but is a pleasure of mere reflection. Without being guided by any purpose or principle, whatever, this pleasure accompanies our ordinary apprehension of an object by means of the imagination, our power of intuition in relation to the understanding, our power of concepts. The apprehension occurs by means of a procedure that judgment has to carry out to give rise to even the most ordinary experience. So now he wants to close the gap. He's going to say that the procedure of reflective judgment is the minimal necessary condition, the minimal necessary subjective condition to give rise to even the most ordinary experience. The only difference is that in the case of ordinary experience, the imagination has to engage in this procedure in order to obtain an empirical objective concept, whereas in the present case, in aesthetic judging, it has to do so merely in order to perceive that the presentation is adequate for giving rise to a harmonious, subjectively purposive activity of the two cognitive powers in their freedom. That is, in order for us to feel the presentational state with pleasure. This pleasure must of necessity rest on the same conditions in everyone, because they are subjective conditions for the possibility of cognition as such, and because the proportion between these cognitive powers that is required for taste is also required for the sound and common understanding that we may presuppose in everyone. So now, in paragraph 39, he goes all the way towards saying that this is nothing but the subjective conditions for this. Now, this thesis gives rise to what is the most famous objection, the Kant's deduction, which, since it's so pervasive, I can simply call the standard objection. And the standard objection is the following. And all variations on this just occur all the time. If it is the case that the link between taste and cognition is direct, then potentially every object about which we can interestedly form a concept should disinterestedly appear beautiful. That is, the standard objection is that if you get them this close, if this really is the precondition for all of this, then potentially anything that we can interestedly know, we can disinterestedly experience as beautiful. And that means that every object, is potentially beautiful. And if that's not the case, if there's something more required, then you have what Ralph Mirbach calls an inscrutable condition. So it looks like we have a puzzle or an aporia, namely either we say every object is potentially beautiful, or there's an inscrutable condition that makes some objects beautiful and some not. Allison twists and turns on this thought. But he ends up, I would argue, with the idea of an inscrutable condition. Namely, some objects are felt to invite this, while other objects are not. And that just seems puzzling. Okay. So, we can go a variety of ways on this. So this is the puzzle, and I want to solve it in three different ways. Okay. Are we all clear about the puzzle? Yeah?
I guess I'm not entirely clear with about why couldn't we say that every object potentially would be beautiful if we could take a disinterested stance, but that we simply cannot really become disinterested with all sorts of things.
That's just the first argument I'm going to take. That's my first solution. So my first solution is, let's bite the bullet and ask ourselves, why can't it be the case, and what's entailed by claiming that if this is, the connection is this, every object that can be judged cognitively is necessarily beautiful. So, how are we going to think about this? Well, the way I've suggested is that is the theory of the lost pleasure. That is, as a matter of, let's call it genealogical fact, not quite historical fact, it is the case that as we first encounter every new object, that they were sources of pleasure, and that is, as we went, as we really did go from here to here, so we actually had to do a two-step process. That is, we schematized without a concept as a condition for forming concepts, and then once we have formed the concepts, then the pleasure drops out, and we just judge. So here it matters that we have in mind objects in their uniqueness, so objects schematized without a concept. Well, how is the best way to think about this? In his book, Imitation in Society, Tom Hoon has, I think, a beautiful thought that connects with the thought of the lost pleasure. He says that ordinary representations are profoundly deceptive because they simultaneously assert and deny their relation to reference. That is, ordinary representations both refer to, and in referring to, depend on their objects, but they also deny it insofar as they claim that the meaning of those objects is given by the concept itself. So the question that arises is that clear? So that the concept read, right, is both clearly related to read representations, and yet we can say that the possession of the concept of read is exhausted by my capacity to distinguish red things from blue, green, yellow things. full stop. That is, it's exhausted not by the relation to the object, but by power for making the requisite distinctions. So in one sense, the meaning of the concept is tied to the object. In another, it's tied to, let's call it, the differential relationships between concepts as they articulate the world. So Hoon goes on to say that representations at once both refer to themselves to some source and deny that they are products of this gesture of referencing. That is, the very notion of a concept is both sourced by experience and simultaneously independent of that experience. And must be independent of experience. Why? Because concepts are general. So they can't be bound to any particular experiences. So there is a tension in the very structure of our representations. Now, Hume thinks about this, I think, in an immensely productive way. He says that the reason for this deception is that determinative judgments, in them, the fit between material and concept, redness and the concept of red, the fit between material and concept, their mutual determination, is so snug that the history of a judgment having been made, of a schema imposing an order between concept and material, is effaced. In short, determinative judgment is overdetermined judgment. That is, when I judge, this is gray. Guess it gets a color. Blue gray. Right. When I say this is gray, or this is a gray sweater, where is the schema? Gray sweater just goes right to the object. So this idea of schematizing is absolutely invisible. So the thought is, when our concepts are operating in their ordinary way, we don't sense that there is, let's call it, a subjective side at all. That is, the sourcing of the concept gray and sweater in the gray sweater is effaced as the concept grasps it, comprehends them. Put it another way, in ordinary judgments, there is no history or genesis of judgment. That they are given, as it were, at a moment, without any conditions of possibility being shown. So, it's this notion that judgments lack a history of judgment. We can restate the problem that is being engaged with in the following way. The typical Kantian claim is that intuitions can only be experienced after concepts have been applied, ignores the fact that we have to learn concepts, that we go on learning new concepts routinely, and that equally routinely we must extend existing concepts into new circumstances. In short, the ordinary judgment can make no sense of concept acquisition and extension, and it's that history of concept acquisition and extension that is suppressed in every ordinary determinate judgment. With this thought in mind, we can then go on to say that reflective judgments of taste is the history of judgment displayed. And it is the history of judgment displayed in a way that reveals the role of the material itself in judgment and giving it its proper due. Yep.
This seems possible with the acquisition and extension of concepts. So you have a sort of Lognes view that indeterminate judgment always assumes reflective.
Right.
But you have to get all the way down to a merely reflective judgment.
Right.
And it seems that this view is not doing that, or at least I haven't heard how yet.
Okay, well, let me see if I can press the argument further, because what I have to now argue, if Kuhn is right, then concepts actually have two aspects, right? They have their aspect of generality, and they have their aspect of dependence on materials. And the argument so far that I'm looking at is what disappears in ordinary determinate judgments is the dependence on the material. And what I need to do is give that a sufficient independence from this. Isn't that your line? Okay. Let me see if I can do that. Thank you for the question. Yeah?
Can you give an account of the ugly using this as well? Or
I haven't given an account of the beautiful yet.
Oh.
But yeah, I think I could.
So would the beautiful just be the remembering of this?
Well, I am going to claim that I certainly want to claim that that on this analysis, beauty is the memory of our experience of the world independent of concepts, but as nonetheless as cognitively engageable. So people often say that beauty is either memorial or utopian, that it either points to a lost past, a Garden of Eden, or an ideal future. And you might say, why is it a talk about that? Because it wants, you may say that beauty is perfectly anarchic. That's another way of reading lawfulness without law, after all. That is perfectly orderly, but without being subsumed under constitutive rules. But in order to make that run, we have to have a notion that can do the work. So let me see if I can thicken the notion of reflective judgment in a way that gives it dependence on material. I'm going to argue is quasi-cognitive. That is, the reason that Kant can't follow through on his own argument is because he just wants this moment to terminate in the judgment X is beautiful. and therefore he doesn't know how to give it a sufficient amount of independence. But if you think about the notion of reflective judgment as itself meaningful but without meaning, lawful without, if we actually try to think what that is involved in that, that is, if we can find or locate another notion of meaning, or another, I want to say another notion of cognition, then we will answer that charge. So this would be, so what I have to do, in order for the lost pleasure theory to work, what I have to deny is that the notion of the aesthetic is non-cognitive. I want to say it's non-discursive cognition. So I want to ask the question, is there such a thing as non-discursive cognition? And furthermore, I have to argue something more. I have to argue that non-discursive cognition is a necessary condition for the possibility of discursive cognition. Yeah?
I'm just wondering if there's a kind of judgment that is not as general as that this, as a, the sweater is gray. So that has some dependence on the material, but it seems like there's some aspect that it's cut off from. So. But so what about like demonstrative judgments?
Great.
Like that gray in particular.
That's perfect. That's the model.
Okay.
So what Gabe is suggesting is, the way John McDowell does it is, what's the role of purely ostensive accounts of the meaning of a concept? So I had this problem. So now I can say, I mean this color. Right. Now, what is this color? Well, all that is going to be count as this color is my capacity to hold it in mind so that if I were to see the same again, I would say the same again. But it's wholly dependent on this instance. So my possession of this color is actually dependent on the very thing and not on a concept independent of it. So that would be a non-predicative or purely ostensive judgment. Now, I want to say that that model of pure ostensive judgment is the model for judging in general. And I have to say something how that could be. And I want to at least borrow the way in which Adorno picks out the notion of reflective judgment. And he calls reflective judgments mimetic. So his notion for non-discursive cognition is mimesis. Well, let me read you a passage about mimesis. And then I'm going to show this is all over Wittgenstein as well. So I'm going to distinguish between two types of understanding. I'll get there. Adorno says, what is aesthetic judging or estimation? He says, if the concept of understanding is meant to indicate something adequate, something appropriate to the matter at hand, which is to say, not merely subsumptive, not merely bringing under an old tired concept, then today it needs to be imagined more as a kind of, now he's going to use a series of mimetic concepts. He says it must be imagined as following along afterward, as the co-execution of the tensions sedimented in the work of art, the processes that have congealed and hence become objectified in it. One does not understand a work of art when one translated it into concepts, but rather when one is immersed in its imminent movement. I should almost say when it is recomposed by the ear in accordance with its own logic, repainted by the eye, or when the linguistic sensorium speaks along with it. Notes to Literature, Volume 2, page 97. Well, here is a corresponding passage from Wittgenstein. Understanding the sentence lies nearer than one thinks to what is ordinarily called understanding a musical theme, where he's imagining to understand a musical theme is simply to hear the theme. I mean, right? You follow it along with your ear. Understanding a sentence is closer than one might think to understanding a musical theme. Why is just this the pattern of variation in loudness and tempo? One would like to say, because I know what it is all about. But what is it all about? I should not be able to say. And then, that was paragraph 527 of the investigations, and this is paragraph 531. We speak of understanding the sentence in the sense in which it can be replaced by another which says the same, but also in the sense in which it cannot be replaced by any other. So, there are two ways of saying we understand a sentence. One, when you can find a perfectly good, right, other way of expressing the same thought. And another one, when we think that to change even the smallest word would alter the meaning. So to understand the sentence in the second way is to understand why that meaning can only be said by using those words in that order and in no other way. We call that kind of meaning poetry. And Wittgenstein goes on. In the one case, the thought of a sentence says something common to different sentences. In the other, something that is expressed only by these words in these positions. So I'm going to say there must be two different ways of understanding. Understanding that allows us to, let's say it in another way, which is, let's say, independent of the object. That's what it means. If I can say it in a lot of different ways, then I can't be fixed on the object. But if the meaning can only be grasped by the concatenation of those sounds in that order, call that a symphony, or those words in that order, call that a poem, then the understanding must be different. So I'm going to call the first type of understanding, let's call it the translatable kind, transitive understanding. And I'm going to call the second type of understanding intransitive understanding. It's intransitive because, right, it stops with the object and is non-detachable from it. So to accept the thought of non-paraphrasability is at least to agree that in some cases to understand something requires the dependence on the object. In which case, if poems are comprehensible, meaningful but without a meaning, I mean, look, Of course you can say, what was that poem about? Oh, it was about all love is painful. That ain't what it was about. There's no way you can, as it were, get the aboutness of it. Because in art, the simplest way to think of that is this. In art, process, the product, the meaning, is dependent on the process by which it is achieved. While, let's say, in science, use the other extreme, the process by which it is gotten makes no difference whatsoever. All we have is the product. Yeah?
Then wouldn't you just want to call that intransitive meaning rather than calling it meaningfulness without a meaning? That seems to be a misphrasing to me.
What I mean is without a transitive meaning.
But I mean, since you're allowing for these two types of understanding, it might be simpler to think of it in terms of the two types of meaning, right? I mean, why...
No, I mean, I think that's just... Just a choice.
But is it not... It seems like it's not just a choice, though, because I think that... I'm not sure what my question is, but I feel like merely reflect the judgment we're at the level of the two different kinds of meaning. I don't know why. But I feel like this is, with all of the examples of poetry and music, well, it seems like it's a step too far. And there has to be some kind of, I'm not certain, but you follow me on this at all? It seems like it's gone too far.
Well, let's see if I can work it back to, I mean, why I used our cases is I'm going to claim that those our cases make perspicuous the ordinary non-art cases. Right. In art, the reason we care about art is, I'm now arguing, right, is because it reveals the material meaning that is the condition for, right, the non-material meaning. That is, it locates the intuition on which the concept is dependent and brings it into the meaning of the concept so that the intuition has its own speaking voice. So schematizing without a concept is a way of asking how intuitions can indeed guide conceptualization and not be reduced to it. So there has to be some notion of pre-meaning or meaningfulness that is not exhausted by conceptuality. And I'm saying that art is a version of that, or certain types of art. Yeah.
Couldn't you easily say, though, that our possibility of having any particular experience of anything at all is predicated on having a language and concepts, and then this would just, and then sort of memorializing that first experience with particulars before concepts would just be the reverse of Platonism, which memorializes concepts before particulars.
Okay, here's why I think it's important. Because after all, what I am certainly claiming is what drops out of this picture is any notion of experience. Right? So what I'm trying to do is ask, what's the relationship between experience and meaning? And there's a whole version of the same argument, by the way, in Being and Time. Has exactly the same structure of argument. The way I'm running it, let me just do this one thought and then we'll have a break. What did I want to say to you? Ah, I know. Here's the thing. In intransitive meaning, there's an essential reference to subjective experience. And the reason is this. In an act of reflective judging, in the first instance, what is before my eyes has to be grasped by me so that the unity of the object is the unity as it is held in mind by me, that is, in my experience of it. So that the very notion that the object has some integrity is only available via the unit. So the unity, because there's no concept, right? So schematizing without a concept is schematizing, let's call it, by the mind alone. So I am someone who hates the linguistic turn, right? I think when philosophy made the linguistic turn, it made a huge mistake. Massive. Why? Because, and this is what Heidegger's worried about, meaning and time, because it thought it could detach language from experience. So he has to reconnect it with experience by his idea of different types of interpretation, different types of meaning. I just want to say that originally, the notion of meaning is meaning held in mind and experienced as meaningful. So that the sense in which Hume is arguing that in referencing the object is a source. It's a source, all right, but its integrity depends on my holding it in mind in exactly the way Gates suggested I hold in mind my impression of this color, only now think of it as this flower. So it's this that I'm struck by. And this is my sense of the rose, that is, that complexity of smell, shape, feel, all of that. How is it connected up? In my experience of it, which then gets articulated by a concept, right? And each of the bits becomes a concept. And then, once that happens, once the concept steps in, what happens? I no longer need a mind. I don't need to hold it in mind. The concept does all the work for me. Right? So I don't actually have to experience the object at all. All I have to do is think of objects as occasions for the act, for the application of a concept. So ordinary life is cognition without experience. Which is to say, ordinary life is exactly the absence of the experience that is the source of the meaning of the concepts. So the reason why we can feel that, Adorno says, all reification is forgetting. What have we forgotten? We've forgotten those intuitions that are the source of the meaning. Think of it another way. Think of the way Heidegger does it. Heidegger has something like this idea. I'm a farmer, you know, and I bag my tomatoes, and I do this, and I do that. And my son comes along, and I say, oh, now, ooh, they're green. You don't pick them yet. They're not ripe. And then I say, ah, yeah, now, tomatoes red. Tomatoes are red. They're ripe. You can pick. What happens is, he goes to school and says, hey, do you know what? When tomatoes are red, they're ripe, and that's when you pick them. The person he tells that thought to has the meaning of the concepts, but totally absent the whole experience that results in. And therefore, and this is what Heidegger in part means by falling, what I call the degeneration of concepts. All concepts enter in a process of degeneration by means of which they are absenting from their own intransitive meaning, so they become purely transitive. Yeah?
I just have a question then about the shareability of the experience, and if it seems that intransitive meaning stops with the object, and in order to communicate the object, you must somehow translate it into a linguistic form, or...
No. Remember, I mean, but even for Kant, that's not the problem. Shareability means you can judge as I judge. That's all communicability means. My judgment is communicable only in the sense of, come here, it's beautiful, meaning it has, now I'm arguing, intransitive sense. Beautiful is just intransitive sense. Yeah?
Now, are you trying to argue that this is Kant, or is this an Adornian overlay onto Kant?
It is... What my argument is, it's certainly not Kant. Why? Because he would not allow reflective judgments to be forms of cognition. On the contrary, he says they're non-cognitive. I'm suggesting that in order to make sense of his own account, he must be committed, if the notion of intuition in here is doing the work that we think it is, that is, it's turned into the notion of schematizing without a concept. So schematizing without a concept replaces the notion of intuition in the first critique. And that's for those of you who know both texts. And what he's allowing, therefore, is intuitions to be meaningful, quote unquote, independently of their conceptual, right? So he's trying to explain how they can play a role in relationship to concepts. I'm simply saying, if he had thought about it, the way Wittgenstein does. So the connection between Wittgenstein and Kant is given in a great article, I think a really great article, by David Bell, called The Art of Judgment, which appeared in, I think it was in Mind, in Mind 96, 1987. Best thing David Bell ever did. The same guy who wrote that very fine Husserl book, good philosopher, wrote a Kantian reading of Frege as well. Pretty nice Frege book. But that article, bees and bees. Okay. One question, then we'll have a break. Yeah?
How singular is this pre-meaning meaningless?
Absolutely singular, because it's bound to this object.
So how would this playing something like the traumatic event? So it's not singular. An object, but like a traumatic event. Experience that.
The problem with a traumatic event is, there's no schematizing at all. There's no free play of the imagination. It shoots right into my mind and repeats itself. Right? So, no free play of the imagination. So, traumatic events are unique, all right, and held in mind, but they're held in mind in a way that displaces everything else. Yeah?
Just dovetailing on that question about singularity, I understand what you're saying about this color, but what if later in the day I see that exact same color and I go, oh, that color? Again, it's no longer singular in a sense.
But that's why, that's the whole point. That I'm saying that we can get from, the idea of a sense of meaning is that it can be meaningful in just this case, just in case it's in principle reapplicable. But it's in principle reapplicable. Why? Because it strikes me as intransitively meaningful. That it strikes me as not just a mess, not as sheer ugliness, not as sublime deforming, but as something that has some integrity in itself, and hence potentially the same again. But I'm not getting the same again out of falling under a concept. The same again is by the acknowledgement of the integrity of the individual case itself. That's why schematizing is both individual and general at the same time. Yeah?
So, because McDowell, of course, would just say, well, that's just a demonstrative concept, so why don't we just call this a concept? concept, whereas you basically want to take on board his rendering of the phenomenon, but say, claim it's something less than a full-blown concept.
Right. And the reason for that, it seems to me, everything goes wrong in McDowell, exactly because he gets the idea of the snugness of fit and never allows the history to enter in. So he just thinks ostension is a particular case of a snug fit. I'm saying the snug fit, which he calls meaningfulness all the way down, actually hides schematizing without concept. It's not an accident that he's never written on the third critique. I think he could not. He denies it. Okay, let's have a break. I've set up